but her taste in Western clothes was questionable. Somehow she poured her ample backside into trousers, much too small for her, and would plonk herself in a chair, knees wide apart. She also had the disconcerting habit of standing up, bending from the waist and digging into her bag on the ground. For maybe a minute, somebody, usually Joe, would have Rashida's huge bottom blocking out the light, inches from his nose, while she rummaged.
"Somebody tell me you write a book,"
she once asked me. "Yes," I said, not elaborating.
"Chickens,"
she said.
"You write about chickens."
"Well, not exactly. It's about our life in sp—"
"You give me book."
Because I'd only brought two copies of my first book, Chickens, with me to Bahrain, I couldn't hand them out freely to anybody who asked.
"Good. You bring me book tomorrow."
I hoped that she'd forget, but she nagged me about it every day until I was forced to hand over a copy. I forgot all about it until a week later, when I was astonished to find a middle school teacher reading my book. "Where did you get that from, if you don't mind me asking?" I said, but I'd already guessed. "Oh, Rashida from the high school sold it to me." Rashida loved to talk, and she always assumed I wanted to chat about chickens. Chapter 10. Bennigan's.
"I hate this place,"
Joe wailed, his elbows resting on the table, his head buried in his hands. We were still living in the hotel, but I knew it wasn't the accommodation that was troubling him.
"I can't teach maths and physics with half classes and classes that keep changing all the time. When are they going to sort this schedule out? Every day it's a fight, with the kids and Miss Darina. Doesn't she realise how hard it is to teach when you don't have a syllabus? If ever I get hold of that worm, I'm going to grind it into the sand with my heel."
"Cheer up," I said. "Ramadan is nearly over. Then we've got a week off, and by the time school starts again, it will probably all be sorted. Life won't be so bad then." By now we were into the second week of September. The sun was still fierce, but we were growing accustomed to it. Often the air above the city was hazy, filled with pollution and sand, blurring the silhouettes of the domed mosques and skyscrapers. There was an atmosphere of suspense. Everybody seemed to be marking time, waiting. The ninth month of the Islamic calendar, Ramadan, was drawing to a close. The fasting from dawn to sunset would soon cease, the shops would open during the day, and celebrations would begin. My students told me that during Ramadan they were all expected to read the Quran through at least once. Every day they rose just before dawn to eat suhoor, the last thing to pass their lips until sundown. They couldn't wait for the end of Ramadan, and Eid al-Fitr, the festival of breaking of the fast, to begin. And neither could I. But first we had to wait for the Islamic elders to declare the crescent moon visible. I parted the curtains, trying to spot the moon through the pollution haze. I remembered nights when Joe and I had gazed up at the clear night sky in Spain and marvelled at the billion stars glittering above. Was this moon that the Islamic clerics were currently studying so carefully the same friendly moon that hung above El Hoyo? It was hard to believe. I dropped the heavy curtain and walked over to Joe. I sat beside him and put my arm around his shoulders.
"It's not just the chaos at school," he said. "I'm so miserable that I've put you through this. I've dragged you out here, and for what? Money? I know, but was it worth it? If I could just whisk ourselves back to Spain, I would, right now."
"It's not so bad."
"It is. And I have it easy compared with you. You have class after class. It's relentless. You have to prepare lessons for yourself as well as that idiot Wayne. You get no recognition for it, and you don't even have time to write."
A hammering on the door made us both jump, and our thoughts were pushed aside. "Come in, it's open," I called, thinking it was Colton or Jake. The door opened, and Toothy sprang into the room.
"Eid Mubarak,"
he cried, and stretched his hand out toward Joe. "That means Happy Eid," I said. "Ramadan must be over. He's waiting for a tip." Joe rummaged in his pocket and handed Toothy a couple of BD. Toothy bowed himself out of the room, and Joe and I looked at each other, our faces wreathed in smiles.
"No school for a week," said Joe,
and we danced around the room. Then the door crashed open, and this time it really was Colton and Jake.
"Hey, have you heard? Ramadan's finished."
"Fancy celebrating?" asked Colton. "You know that place behind the hotel, Bannigan's? It's an Irish pub, and it's open."
We couldn't have vacated the room faster if we'd been chased by a herd of rabid camels. The bus passed Bannigan's every day, but I'd never given it much thought, as it was shuttered up during Ramadan. Now a green neon light was flashing a welcome, and the doors were open. The four of us skipped in. I'd be lying if I said that Bannigan's was exactly like an Irish pub. It wasn't. The building did not remotely resemble an Irish pub, but we liked it. Big green cutouts of shamrocks were pasted in odd places, and a television was mounted on almost every wall. Judging by the hubbub, the other customers were mostly from the American naval base, although there were also several Arabs. Bennigan's staff were not Irish, but Filipino, and utterly charming. They learned our names that first evening, and never forgot them.
"Sergio, what you like to drink?"
Beer for me, white wine for Vicky, and whatever Jake and Colton want."
Such ordinary words, but in such surreal surroundings. Soon we had glasses lined up on the table in front of us, and the party really began. We were so unused to alcohol it went straight to our heads. Everything was hilarious. I remember that night with huge affection. It was exactly what Joe needed, and the birth of the Bennigan's Working Men's Drinking Club, BWMDC, of which I, being female, was an honorary member. It was that night that I discovered I could bark like a Jack Russell and became known as Dog's Body. Being with Colton and Jake, so full of intelligence, nonsense and energy, was like being with two bright puppies. We loved it. Bennigan's became our meeting house, a precious place to escape from other staff, from school, from Bahrain. If anybody wanted to join us, we politely chased them away. Bennigan's was ours, where we shared memories, secrets, hopes and dreams. If any of us was having a tough time, or had a difficult decision to make, we'd call an extraordinary BWMDC meeting at Bennigan's, and all four of us would be there. The next morning we had the luxury of staying in bed because there was no school. I carefully opened my eyes. It felt as if six midgets were wrestling behind my eyeballs. Of course, Eid had started. Bennigan's, the formation of the BWMDC. I opened the curtains and saw the bright lights of the stores and restaurants opposite, all open for business. I groaned. I'd promised myself to go clothes shopping after Ramadan. Now all the shops and malls were open, I had no excuse. Hailing a taxi in Manama is easy, but choosing which mall to shop in isn't. Should I go to the Dana Mall or Marine Mall? Or the Lulu Centre near the Pearl Monument? In the end, I decided on the City Centre Mall, just because it was the biggest. Saeed had recommended it when I'd inquired at Smoker's Corner.
"City Centre is the best. At City Centre you can get
lots of things?"
"No.
Lovely things?"
"No. Lost, because it is so big."
"Yes,
I like City Centre the bestest,"
said Rashida, who had just woken herself up with an elephantine snort.
"You can go to the food hall and try all the samples. Sometimes I go there when I do not want to cook for my own self, and I do not spend one fill."
City Centre was everything that I'd been promised, and more. I'd never seen such a huge, glitzy mall. The marble floors stretched away in every direction. Numerous escalators rose to brightly lit upper floors, Shop windows glittered with designer merchandise. Shopping here was going to be easy, wasn't it? I'm not a city gal, and shopping fills me with dread, but I was confident that I'd find everything I wanted. I needed some outfits for school, with sleeves that covered my arms. With Joe trailing behind me, I rifled through racks of clothes, trying to find something suitable, which turned out to be a much harder task than I'd imagined. To my surprise, everything on display was low-cut, skimpy, glittery, or a combination of all three. Rack after rack of strumpet wear. How was that possible, when Muslim ladies are dressed from head to toe in black with only their faces or just eyes showing? Who buys these clothes? We deduced something that day. Outwardly, Muslim ladies are the picture of anonymity and decorum, but underneath those veils, who knows what saucy showgirls are lurking? The telephone rings and I pick it up. It's my son.
Mum, is that you? How's Bahrain?
Hello! Oh, it's fine. Taking a bit of time to settle in, but Bahrain is a nice place, and the Bahraini people are really friendly and helpful. Some things take a bit of getting used to, like weekends being Friday and Saturday. Hey, I thought you were on holiday with Anna in the Seychelles.
Yes, we are.
Are you having a good time?
Fantastic.
What are the Seychelles like?
Perfect. We're staying in a lovely place. The beaches are fabulous, the food's great. Beautiful weather. Really enjoying it.
Oh, good.
Oh, and by the way, Hannah and I just got married.
You... What?
Hold on, Hannah wants a word.
I hear him pass the phone to a giggling Hannah. Hello, mother-in-law. Oh, my... It's not a joke, then. You just got married. Laughter in the background. Yep, we just didn't want any fuss. And it's like paradise here, so we just went ahead and did it. Well... Congratulations. For once, I'm struggling to find words. I'm delighted, but profoundly shocked. It takes a BWMDC extraordinary meeting before Joe and I can fully absorb the news. How we enjoyed that week of Eid. The school's promise to move us into our new apartment didn't materialize, but that didn't matter to us. Although poor young Mohammed was beside himself. Each day living with Brent was torture for him. We got lazy about cooking, ordering fast food that arrived on a scooter, delivered by an Indian. We swam in the rooftop pool, unless Brent was there first, and explored our surroundings. We spent far too much time at Bennigan's, and revelled in the fact that we didn't need to rise at 5:30 in the morning. All good things must inevitably come to a close, and Sunday, the 19th of September 2010, arrived much too quickly. Now we would start teaching in earnest. The schedule for the middle school was complete, although the high school only had a makeshift timetable with which to work. Jasim was already parked on the sand outside the hotel. We all piled onto the bus, Mohammed sitting as far from Brent as possible. Tex and Andrea and her roommate Saja chatted, heads together. Ibekwe, oblivious, hummed songs to himself. Jasim raised a can of Coke, glugged a mouthful, accelerated across bumpy sand and into the morning traffic. We picked up Hawa, who was already waiting outside her apartment block. Today she wore scarlet, her hijab embroidered with tiny pink flowers and intertwined leaves.
"Good morning, everybody,"
she called as she settled herself. "Morning, Hawa," we chorused, and held on tight as the bus lurched away again and joined a busy main road. I was lost in my own thoughts when Jasim, twisting the steering wheel, veered into the oncoming traffic. Some teachers closed their eyes, others, like me, gripped the handrail tighter. Joe laughed. Without slowing the bus, Jasim hurled his empty Coke can at an open trash bin on the opposite pavement, missed, shrugged, then swung the bus back into the correct traffic lane.
"Bad luck, Jasim,"
Joe shouted, and Jasim smiled at him, gold teeth glinting, in his rearview mirror. I wondered if I'd ever get used to Jasim's erratic driving. As usual, there was a distinct lack of camels, but Mercedes, Ferraris and Range Rovers were plentiful outside the school. Today there were many more vehicles. Ramadan was over, and school was beginning in earnest. Jasim barged the bus through the traffic and pedestrians, scolding parents for blocking the main entrance. We clocked in, black for once, and made our way into the school building. Pots of pink and red petunias had been placed around the courtyard, adding a welcome splash of colour. As the students waited outside for the first school bell to ring, I made my way to the staff room, where Mr. Brewster was holding a hurried meeting. Chapter 11. Children and Chickens.
"Welcome back," said Mr. Brewster, looking round at us all. "Just two main points this morning. Firstly, we've had a delivery of some new overhead projectors, the little portable ones that you can link to your computers. They're not enough for everybody, so we'll have to share. I've labelled them with the names of those who are getting them. Please collect them on your way out."
I was near the projectors and flicked my eyes over the labels. I immediately saw I hadn't been allocated one, although Wayne had. In fact, it seemed as though only the male teachers had been allotted one.
"Secondly, we've been warned that the Ministry of Education is making a surprise inspection."
Ah, that explained the sudden appearance of the petunias outside.
"Please make sure your classrooms are in order and that your bulletin boards are looking attractive. We can all learn a lesson from Wayne, whose boards are already looking wonderful."
I looked around for Wayne, but he wasn't in the room. The school bell shrilled and we all turned to leave.
"Oh, and please collect your class lists,"
shouted Mr. Brewster. I grabbed my stack and quickly scanned them. Fatima's name jumped out at me.
"Miss Vicky,"
called Mr. Brewster,
"Wayne has phoned in sick. Would you mind finding some work for his classes and starting him off?"
Look after my own back-to-back classes and Wayne's. This was going to be a heavy day.
"You see what I say?" said Hawa, as we hurried to our rooms. "Mr. Brewster, he like men best. I not get projector either."
A boisterous rabble of kids was rioting outside my classroom, waiting for me to open the door.
"Right, class," I shouted above the din. "I'm going to unlock the door now, and I want you to come in quietly and find a seat. You may sit where you like, just for today. Tomorrow you'll have a seating plan. I need to go and sort out Mr. Wayne's class, so you can talk quietly amongst yourselves while you wait for me."
I unlocked the door and stood back as they surged into the classroom like a tsunami. Then I ran down the corridor to speak to Wayne's class and give them some work. On my return, I heard my class long before I saw them. I paused in the doorway, surveying the scene. One boy was wearing the waste paper basket on his head and dancing between the desks. Another two were doodling on the whiteboard, using permanent markers. A wrestling match was taking place at the back of the room, complete with cheering spectators. My carefully pasted paper had already been torn from the windows, and three boys were leaning out, bawling at others still outside in the courtyard. Just one girl sat still and upright in the front row, hands clasped primly in her lap. Fatima. I was just opening my mouth to yell at the class when a flinty voice beside me stopped me in my tracks. "Miss Vicky? I was just checking that Fatima had found the correct classroom. I see she has. I sincerely hope this is not an example of your teaching methods." Fatima's mother. Why did she always turn up at the most difficult times? I opened my mouth to explain that I'd been sorting Mr. Wayne's class, but didn't get a chance to speak. "Fatima's education is extremely important. She cannot work in this kind of environment. Please make sure that Fatima is given homework tonight." Parting shot delivered, she swept away, black robes swishing with disapproval. A flashback of Spain crowded into my mind. I saw Joe and myself on our roof terrace, a glass of Paco's wine in our hands, heads tipped back to watch a pair of eagles soaring above the mountain tops, the valley bristling with green pines, and bee-eaters chattering in the almond trees. Impatiently I banished the memory, together with a wave of homesickness, and took a deep breath. 10 minutes later, order in the classroom was restored. I discovered that I was already familiar with many in the class. Cheeky Mohammed, moon-faced Mohammed, the chubby girl Zainab, Ahmed, Yaza, and Fatima. Another boy was proving to be even cheekier and louder than Mohammed. "Please don't interrupt when I'm speaking," I warned him. "Only one person speaks at a time in my classroom. What is your name?"
"Mees, most of a camel, Mees."
I scrutinised his face to check he wasn't joking. He wasn't.
"And your name?"
I smiled at a tiny girl with a long, thick plait that hung down her back. She remained staring down at her desk.
"What is your name?"
I asked again. No reply.
"Mees," said Cheeky Mohammed. "That's Huda, and she doesn't speak."
"You mean she doesn't speak English?" Huda's fingers gripped her pencil so tightly I thought it would snap.
"No, Mees, she doesn't speak, Mees."
Great. That's all I needed. A mute in the class as well. "Never mind," I said. "I'm sure she'll speak when she's ready." I turned my back to write the day's vocabulary list on the board, which was a mistake. Mustafa Camel knocked Cheeky Mohammed's pencil tin to the floor with a crash. Ahmed ripped some more paper off the window glass. Yaza made a face at Zainab and was rewarded with a slap. Only Fatima, in the front row, was neatly copying the words into her exercise book. "Who emptied a bottle of Tippex over my desk?" I asked, horrified at the sticky white pool beginning to congeal.
"What's Tippex, Miss?"
asked Yaza. "Tippex. Whiteout, blanco, whatever you want to call it," I snapped.
"Miss, it was Huda, Miss," yelled Master of a Camel, making the class shout with laughter.
Huda shrank even more into herself, her face expressionless, her eyes still fixed on her desk. I knew she hadn't moved. I couldn't prove it, but I was pretty sure the culprit was Mustafa Camel. I learned a lesson that day, one that helped me through the rest of those torrid days. Every morning, before school began, I wrote the day's vocabulary list on the board. That way I needn't turn my back, and I could police my pupils as they copied from the board.
"Miss," said Fatima just before the bell rang, "you've spelled colour wrong."
She was right, of course, and I was wrong. I'd automatically spelt it the British way, but as we were in an American school, I should have written C-O-L-O-R. From that day on, Fatima delighted in catching me out with British/American spelling. I had a precious free period and made my way to Smoker's Corner, hoping Joe would be there. Joe, Saeed, and some others were roaring with laughter at another story Colton was relating about floating down the Boise River.
"Hey, so my buddy Tucker, he hates the cops, and they're on every bridge looking down, checking out if we've got beer, which ain't allowed. Well, my buddy Tucker, he just flips over onto his stomach, and when we go onto this bridge, he pulls his shorts down and moons some at the cops."
Asked Saeed when the story was over.
"Do it again? Yeah, loads of times. No, did he drown?"
suggested Joe, rather unhelpfully.
"No, did he drink Coors? You said the Coors factory was nearby."
Alcohol was a subject of fascination to our Muslim friends, most of whom had never let a single drop pass their lips.
"When you take alcohol?"
asked Yusuf, the Egyptian information technology teacher and father of newborn triplets in Cairo.
"When you drink,
How do you get home?
Joe and Colton looked puzzled.
Bennigan's isn't far away, said Joe.
No, I mean, don't you fall over? I was told that your legs don't work after drinking alcohol.
The high school bell rang, and being the only middle school teacher there, I was left alone. I got my books out to plan the next day's lessons, just as Rashida arrived. With a chipped fingernail, she retrieved her half-smoked cigarette from the groove in the wall and sat down, knees wide apart.
"How are your chickens?"
she asked as usual. "I don't know," I replied. "I expect they're fine. Our neighbour in Spain is looking after them while we're away." Rashida fumbled in her bag and brought out a small mirror and a pair of tweezers. She leaned her head back and began plucking hairs from her chin, holding the mirror to study her work.
"You remember I tell you about our chickens in our balcony in Beirut?"
she asked, after a plucking pause.
"Oh, yes."
"My husband, he tell me that our grandson, he just loves the chickens."
I smiled and waited for her to continue.
"My little grandson, every day he asks, 'Grandfather, grandfather, please can we buy a husband for the chickens?' So my husband, he say, 'Yes.'"
"Did he get one?"
"Oh, yes. A very, very beautiful husband for the chickens. Many, many colors. And the chickens, they love their new husband."
"That's nice."
"No. My husband say it no big problem."
Rashida plucked a few more hairs and shook her head.
"Why?"
"The chicken husband, he have very bad attitude, very bad. Now he not let my husband go into the balcony. He want to fight all the time."
"Oh, dear.
The chicken husband, he love my grandson. He not start a fight with my grandson. But he hate my husband."
Memories of our feisty little cock in Spain came flooding back. Cocky had been a nightmare, and I sympathized.
"And the chicken husband, he crawls so loud. He crawls all through the day, and he crawls all through the night. My husband, he not sleep, and the neighbors, they are calling him, asking if it is his chicken crawling all the time."
"What did he say?"
Rashida brushed cigarette ash from her knee and chuckled.
"My husband, he tell neighbors it not his chicken. But this security man, he know we have chickens in our balcony. My husband, he say the chicken husband must go. But when he say that, my grandson, he cries. Cries very much."
I could see that this was a difficult problem, and wondered how it could be resolved. I opened my mouth to speak, but Rashida had already fallen asleep, mouth wide open, hands resting on the mirror and tweezers in her lap. On the bus home that day, I noticed that Halle Berry was missing. "He's bought himself a jeep," said Andrea in her Texan drawl. "At least we won't have him breathing all over us any more." "Do you know, he asked me on a date the other day. The thought of it." As the days rolled by, I slowly shaped a workable routine for myself. It was exhausting, as every class produced work and homework to be assessed. Apart from planning lessons, I usually had 80 assignments to grade daily. Wayne was frequently absent, which meant extra work for me. Mr. Brewster still sang Wayne's praises at every opportunity, and I gathered that they were socializing together, out of school. But I was coping, and in spite of myself, I was growing fond of my unruly charges, even Mustafa Camel and Cheeky Mohammed. Joe, however, was not adapting so well. Chapter 12. Brent. To Joe's frustration, his schedule was still being chopped and changed. Every week different faces appeared in his classes. Worse still, the students were beginning to see through his fierce exterior and were taking advantage.
"They actually bring their breakfast to eat during my lesson," he complained. And if I'm in the science lab, they make tea on the Bunsen burners.
Well, stop them, I said.
I can't. They're very polite. And they always make some for me, too. I haven't the heart to shout at them.
Are they doing any work?
A handful, maybe, but the rest just use my lessons as a social gathering. When I do a head count, I always find twice as many kids as I should have, because they invite their friends from other classes.
It can't be that bad.
It is. It is that bad. I'm telling you, Vicky, if things don't improve, I think we need to leave. Go back home to Spain at Christmas. I think I'll go insane if I have to stay here. I can't teach teenagers who don't want to learn. I'm getting too old for this.
I truly sympathised. These children, whom we were supposed to be teaching, had little desire to learn. Why should they? They came from rich families with secure futures. For them, attending school was compulsory, but actual learning, getting an education, wasn't important at all. However, we had signed contracts to work for a year. We couldn't just pull out. Rumours abounded of past teachers who simply disappeared, unable to take the stress. A little heap of keys were found on the desk, and the teacher vanished, never to be seen or heard from again. But I felt the school had been good to us. We were well paid and provided for, even though the work was grueling. I wasn't ready to give up. But Joe became steadily more downhearted. Had it not been for Colton, Jake and Bennigan's, our oasis in the desert, I think he would have booked an immediate flight home. As it was, I was determined to jolly him along, at least until Christmas. So I was pleased when Joe made an announcement, particularly as it concerned his beloved sport, football.
"I volunteered to help with the after-school soccer club,"
he said, rare, genuine pleasure in his eyes.
"You know Jane, the physical education teacher at the high school?"
"Yes, I did know Jane. American, built like an Olympic shot putter. She was, in fact, the athletics director for the entire school. Her husband was a quiet henpecked chap who taught PE in the middle school." "That's good," I said brightly, trying not to calculate the years since Joe had last played soccer. Of course, back in Spain he'd kicked a ball round the village square with you Farty boys and Geronimo, but that probably didn't count. It might do him good to thunder around a proper football pitch with the high school boys' soccer team. Perhaps it might cheer him up, and he'd forget about booking a flight home to Spain. Unfortunately, it didn't go well. Joe played a lot of football when he was younger, and is a qualified referee. He turned up at the gymnasium, looking the part, shiny new whistle in hand. He ran on the spot, warming up, then practised a few intricate ball skills, hoping to impress the watching ASS High School first team with his fancy footwork. "Your team is over there," said Jane. But Joe was now practising his header techniques, bouncing the ball on his head and concentrating on keeping it in the air. "Mr. Joe, your team is waiting for you over there." "Right," said Joe, eager to begin coaching the senior boys. He gathered up the ball and looked around. "Over there," repeated Jane, and waved a muscular arm at the far corner of the gym, where a group of 10-year-old girls stood watching curiously. Joe had been given the grade 6 girls' team. He didn't mind. The football pitch was in the gym, it being much too hot to play outside, and the girls were enthusiastic. At the end of the session he was exhausted, but had to wait until the last child was collected by her parents. It was only then that he realised he had no money for a taxi, no phone, and nobody left to give him a ride home. Sighing, he set out on the long trek back to the hotel. The sun beat down relentlessly, his new trainers gave him blisters, and he had brought no water. Of course, I was oblivious to all this. Had I known about his predicament, one word to Jake or Colton would have sent them speeding out in their car to collect him. Joe finally arrived home, almost crawling. His head was as red as the Bahraini flag, his heart raced, and his body shook. I believe any longer in the sun would have made him seriously ill. "But did you enjoy the session?" I asked much later, when he'd sufficiently recovered to tell me all about it.
"Yes," he said, "I did enjoy it. The girls were super.
Apart from the walk home, the only thing I objected to was one of the parents. There was this mother on the sidelines, all dressed in black. I could see her shaking her head at every decision I made, and she watched her daughter like a hawk.
What did the daughter look like?
Oh, you know, dressed like all the others, in a tracksuit with long sleeves. Nice-looking girl, very determined. Wasn't wearing a hijab, had long, very curly hair and a pale face. I'm sorry, but I don't recall her name. There were too many to remember.
He didn't need to. I knew exactly who he was describing. Jo had met Fatima and her dreaded mother. Unfortunately, Joe's soccer coaching experience didn't last long. He'd bitten off more than he could chew, even with the middle school girls' team, and, much to my relief, resigned. Luckily, it was a Thursday evening, the beginning of the weekend. A visit to Bennigan's would revive his spirits. A raucous BWMDC meeting, followed by some rest, saw Joe well on the road to recovery. By Sunday, the start of the new week, he was almost his miserable old self again. Darina, on the other hand, was struggling with demons of her own. "So many problems," she confided. "I've fallen out big time with the three fat ladies, and I'm getting really negative responses from all the teachers about my new rules." Of course, I already knew about all the ructions at the high school, through Joe, Colton and Jake. The new rules were a frequent topic of hilarity at our Bennigan's meetings. The latest was the coffee war. Mrs. Sherazy, the owner, had informed Darina that members of staff were no longer permitted to drink coffee in the classrooms. "Personally, I don't care if they drink coffee or not," said Darina. "But if it's what Mrs. Sherazy wants, well, she's the boss." Mr. Brewster had issued the same edict, but the middle school staff simply continued with their coffee habits, but furtively. Most of the high school staff did, too. Only one silly young teacher insisted on having a permanent mug of coffee on her desk and in full view. Not only that, but she would teach her lessons, coffee in hand, frequently taking sips. It was only a matter of time before Darina caught her, coffee-handed. Darina reprimanded her. The young teacher complained that she was being picked on. The three fat ladies sided with her, and the whole matter was completely blown out of proportion. And then there was the one-way rule. To reduce congestion during lesson breaks, Darina devised a system whereby students moved in one direction, along corridors and staircases. Joe, Colton and Jake had described it in great detail at Bennigan's, using ashtrays, beer mats and matchsticks. Of course, they added their own personal touches, with proposed traffic lights, parking bays and no-entry signs. In reality, the traffic police had already been appointed. Halle Barry had assigned himself the task, and loved to stand at strategic points, bawling instructions and blasting bad breath at the students. Jake had a gift for mimicry, and his arm-waving performances had the whole of Bennigan's laughing. "What am I to do about Brent?" asked Arena one day. "The man's completely insane. The students and parents complain about him all the time. He loses their work, and do you know, he wastes 40 minutes every lesson just taking the register. He insists on spelling each name out loud. God only knows why. I've had to take some classes away from him. But you won't believe the latest drama." I was all ears. Nothing that Brent said or did surprised me any more. Darina shook her head in disbelief and launched into the latest tale. Brent had been allocated one of the brand new projectors. Being a floater, he had no classroom of his own, and therefore nowhere to store it. Darina suggested he keep it in one of her cupboards in the principal's office, which he did. Brent needed the projector, came to collect it, and opened the cupboard. No projector. Brent's reaction was as unpredictable as ever.
"Where's my projector?"
"I don't know. When did you last see it?" asked Arena.
"It was in this cupboard."
"Are you sure? Perhaps you forgot to put it away."
"No, it was here. I always put it back in here."
"Well, that's very strange.
Somebody has stolen it."
"Brent, nobody has keys to this office apart from me, you, and Mr. Saeed from stationery. This room is always locked."
"You took it."
Come on, Brent. Why would I want to take your projector?
You took it.
Oh, for goodness sake. You stole it. Brent, I've been overseas for the past few days. This was true. Darina had been away on school business. How could I take your projector, even if I wanted to? Darina paused in her storytelling, rolled her eyes at me, and flung her arms out in disbelief, knocking over a pile of papers that fluttered to the floor. "Did you ask Saeed in stationery about it?" I asked, helping her pick them up. "Oh, yes, I spoke to him right away. Of course he hadn't taken it. Why would he? So off Brent goes, fuming and telling anybody that will listen how the principal stole his projector. And then the three fat ladies take up the story and spread it around. Honestly, this place..." Darina was laughing. The whole affair was so ridiculous it was funny. The mystery of the disappearing projector was solved a week later. Saeed had taken it upon himself to check every classroom. Another teacher, named Malaria or Asthma or Cholera, I don't exactly remember, had found an unattended projector and borrowed it.
"I checked the serial number," Saeed told Arena, "and it was Brent's."
Brent hadn't put it in the cupboard after all. And nobody had stolen anything. Darina was innocent, but few people were ever aware that her name had been cleared. Another week began, and the usual crowd was waiting in the hotel foyer for the school bus. I glanced at my watch. "Jasim's very late today," I said. "Ah, you know what he's like," drawled Andrea. She looked tired, as though she'd not had much sleep. "We're going to be really late," I said. "I dread to think what my class is getting up to." I could only imagine what Mustafa Kamel and Cheeky Mohammed were doing in my absence. They were hard enough to control when I was in the room, but left unsupervised. The hands on my watch ticked round, and still Jasim didn't appear.
"I'll go outside and see if he's coming," said Joe, pushing through the hotel swing doors.
"Where is Brent?" somebody asked. We all looked round. Brent wasn't there.
"I saw him earlier,"
Ibekwe commented. Ibekwe, from Ghana, taught biology, and was always the first person in the foyer waiting for the bus.
"He went outside."
"No sign of the bus," said Joe, returning, accompanied by a surge of heat. "Was Brent out there?"
"Nope."
"Bus? Bus for school?" "Bus gone,"
said Toothy, popping up from behind the reception desk like a jack-in-the-box. Everybody swung round to the desk. "The bus has come and gone."
"Are you sure? We're 25 minutes late already."
"That's ridiculous. Jasim wouldn't leave with an empty bus."
"Not empty," said Toothy, and held up one brown finger. "Not empty. One man."
Brent. Brent had boarded the bus and allowed Jasim to drive away without telling him that we were all waiting inside.
"That Brent! What a moron!"
"What was Brent thinking? Why didn't he call us?
What a stupid thing to do!"
"I'm not walking to school in this heat."
The outrage was palpable. I shook my head in disbelief and pulled out my mobile phone. "Darina, that idiot Brent has let Jasim drive away without us. Can you send Jasim back again, please?" We eventually arrived at school, flustered and annoyed. Jasim informed us that Brent had told him to drive on, and he'd assumed we'd already gone to school by other means. We clocked in, and our cards were punched in bright red ink. I sprinted to my classroom, hardly registering the shadowy figure of Fatima's mother in the corridor. I was relieved to find Mr. Brewster in the classroom doorway, overseeing my bunch of hooligans. "I'm so sorry," I said, breathless and sweating. "The bus left without us."
"That's okay," said Mr. Brewster. "Could you pop into my office for a moment when you finish your classes? I need a word with you."
Chapter 13. A horrible day and shopping. There wasn't time to wonder what Mr. Brewster wanted to talk about. I had my lesson to sort, and, thanks to Brent, I wasn't at all prepared. I hadn't written the day's vocabulary list on the board, again, thanks to Brent, and I couldn't do it now. Turning my back on the kids for any length of time was not an option. But I needed to get the class focused as soon as possible. "Right, class," I said. "Please get out your Shiloh books and turn to the next chapter." The class groaned.
"Miss, Shiloh is a stupid book, miss. Miss, we don't want to read about a stupid dog, miss."
Only Fatima sat, her back ramrod straight, book open, pen poised, ready to take notes. Shiloh would not have been my choice of a class text. It is about a small boy who rescues a beagle, or bagel as most of the class spelled it, and because few of them liked animals, it wasn't a popular read. I rummaged in my bag for my own copy and couldn't find it. Impatiently, I turned my bag upside down, and the contents spewed out on my desk. No time to tidy it up now, I thought. Must get on with this lesson before they start playing up. I ignored the mess on my desk, grabbed my copy of Shiloh, and began to read. I couldn't really blame the class for not being interested in the story. It is set in West Virginia, a lush, green, mountainous place, totally unlike the flat desert that is Bahrain. The text was peppered with unfamiliar American words that needed explaining.
"What does buckshot mean?"
asked Cheeky Mohammed. "Does anyone know?" I asked the class.
"Does it mean tired?"
asked Zainab. "No, but a good try," I said. "Anybody else care to guess?" I looked round the classroom, but even Fatima shook her head. Huda shrank into herself, terrified that I might ask her. I always tried hard to make my lessons lively, so I seized a board pen from the pile of junk on my desk and quickly drew a big cartoon rabbit on the whiteboard, its paws held up to crying eyes. Then I drew a shotgun, with dots to show buckshot leaving the barrel and landing on the rabbit. I used a red marker for drops of blood, knowing that kids love gore. The shotgun interested the boys hugely. I was just calming the class again when there was a tap on the door. Before I had the chance to call come in, the door opened and Mrs. Sherazy entered, her face fixed in an artificial smile, synthetic black hair cascading over her shoulders. Why was the school owner visiting my classroom? I wondered. The children fell silent, aware that something unusual was happening. Little Hooda's eyes were like satellite dishes. I opened my mouth to say good morning, but nothing came out. Mrs. Sherazy ignored me and came deeper into the room, but not before she'd taken in the disgraceful pile of junk on my desk and the drawing of the gun and sobbing bunny on the board. To my horror, a procession followed her. Mr. Brewster, four men in suits, three ladies in abayas and hijabs, and two men carrying photographic equipment. My classroom was so cramped I was backed up against the window to make room for the visitors. I was painfully aware of the chaos on my desk and the drawing on the board. Two of the ladies began firing questions at the class, none of which I understood as I spoke no Arabic. The suited men picked on individual kids and asked more questions. I was relieved that none asked Hood or anything, as they would have a long wait for an answer. The photographer's cameras flashed. Mrs. Sherazy's fixed smile never wavered, although it never reached her eyes. At last, as suddenly as they'd appeared, they departed. "Who were they?" I asked the class, who looked as shocked as I was.
"The Ministry of Education," said Fatima primly. "They are inspecting the school."
"Oh, and what did they ask you?"
"Miss, they ask if we like the school, miss," said Mustafa Camel.
"And if we like our lessons," said Zainab.
"And if we like you, miss," said Cheeky Mohammed.
I changed the subject. I didn't want to hear the replies the children had given. At last the end of the day arrived, but instead of meeting my friends at Smoker's Corner, I had to report to Mr. Brewster's office. The door was open, and Mr. Brewster and Wayne were chatting and laughing together. Wayne looked at me.
"Hi, babe,"
he said. Then to Mr. Brewster,
"I'll see you later tonight."
They high-fived, and Wayne sauntered out of the office. I am not your babe, I thought, and walked in.
Ah, Miss Vicky,
Mr. Brewster began.
I'm afraid I've had a complaint from a parent.
It didn't need the brain of Bahrain to work out who had complained.
Fatima, she's in your class?
He asked, eyebrows raised as if he didn't already know. Yes.
Her mother says you're not setting enough homework.
I...
Fatima's friend is in Wayne's class, and she's told Fatima that they have an hour's English homework every night.
But I was fuming. I knew that Wayne ordered his classes to copy great chunks from the textbooks, and I didn't see the point of that. He didn't even grade it. He just stamped it with a rubber stamp as checked. I set my classes meaningful homework 3 times a week, I said, through clenched teeth.
Well, could you step it up to every day in future?
Great. More grading. Could this day get any worse? It could.
Oh, the ministry visit today went well, I think,
said Mr. Brewster, swiftly changing the subject, probably aware that I was far from happy. I left before the subjects of untidy teachers' desks and tragic bunnies could be raised, and went straight to Hawa.
You see, I tell you, that woman is bad, said Hawa, rolling her eyes. She better not try to bully me.
I believed her. Hawa looked small and delicate, but I knew that beneath her beautifully embroidered clothes beat the heart of a cockerel.
Ha! Soon we have parents' conference. Then we see...
She clapped her hands, bedevilment in her eyes. But it was the email that arrived that evening that was the final straw that broke the camel's back and drove me to call a BWMDC extraordinary meeting.
Dear Miss Vicky, Fatima did not understand today your lesson on reported speech. She needs clarification and explanation. Please repeat it tomorrow. And why do you not give a quiz today, like in Mr. Wayne's class? Fatima's mother.
Thankfully, the Bahraini people we came to know were utterly charming, friendly, supportive people, not at all like Fatima's mother. When Darina had a small crisis at the shopping mall, they couldn't have been kinder. Darina was always beautifully dressed and enjoyed shopping for clothes. One day she was browsing happily from store to store when she suddenly realized she'd lost her handbag. It was black and contained everything. Phone, credit cards, ID, passport, wallet. Panic set in. She forced herself to get a grip and thought hard. When did she last have it? She didn't believe it had been stolen. No, it was more likely that she'd put it down somewhere. But where? And how would she get back to the hotel with no money? She approached a sales girl behind the counter and explained her problem. Although the girl didn't know Darina from a piece of toffee, she insisted on giving her 10 BD, approximately £17 or $26, from her own purse, more than enough for a taxi home. Darina gratefully accepted. She thought hard again. Ah, the phone. She made her way over to one of the security guards and told him the sorry tale. Again, the security guard couldn't have been more sympathetic or helpful. He agreed to keep calling her phone while Darina attempted to retrace her steps once more. God bless that nice man, said Darina as she relived the incident. Do you know? He called my phone about 50 times. Well, about an hour later, I walked into the store where I first thought I'd lost my purse, walked about, and then, all of a sudden, dee-dee-dee, diddly-dee-dee-dee, I heard the familiar music. It was my phone. I followed the melody to the sweater pile, just where I'd been standing 2 hours before, and there, sure enough, was my purse, ringing. My purse was black, and I'd put it down on a pile of black sweaters. I must have held up a sweater to look at, then put it down on top of my purse. Then I must have picked up my shopping bags and walked away. But everything was there, and nothing was missing. What a relief! Yes, it was. So I thanked that wonderful security guard, and gave the nice sales girl her 10 BD back, and all was well. Shopping was never a problem for Joe and me, because we had a nearby cold store or mini supermarket.
but carrying the shopping home was a problem. We usually had to buy heavy bottles of water, as Bahraini water is unsafe to drink, and lugging it home across the sand, in the searing heat, was exhausting. One of the middle school teachers overheard Joe moaning about it, and interrupted.
"Hey, I've got a cart at home that we never use, a kind of trolley thing. Do you want it? It's just taking up space. You're welcome to it if you want it."
Joe accepted, and the next day she produced the trolley. Trollster, as we christened it, entered our lives. Trollster was a very sturdy trolley, and much bigger than we'd imagined. It had a metal frame, four large stable wheels, and folded up when not in use. Joe was looking forward to his maiden voyage.
"I'll stock up on everything,"
he announced. "We need water, milk, everything."
Joe often went shopping for groceries alone, because I was weighed down grading my pupils' work and couldn't afford the time. Off he went, pushing Trollster in front of him. All went well as he traversed the sand, and from my vantage point on the seventh floor, I saw him cross the busy road with no problems. Unfortunately, the return journey was much more hazardous. 20 minutes later, I watched him exit the cold store, Trollster packed with groceries. He pushed it to the curb, waited for the traffic lights to change and the road to clear, then attempted to negotiate the curbstone. Trollster lurched sideways, spilling toilet rolls and cans into the road. Colton arrived, looking for Joe, and joined me at the window. We watched the little figure stamp its foot and hurriedly retrieve the fallen items. The traffic lights changed to green, and the traffic roared towards him. With just moments to spare, he hauled Trollster back on the curb. Again, he waited for the lights to change, and this time reached the opposite curb without further mishap. He just managed to pull Trollster up onto the pavement before the lights changed, and the traffic bore down on him again.
That was tricky, chuckled Colton.
We watched as Joe and Trollster bumped across the red brick sidewalk, until that gave way to compacted sand. Joe pushed confidently and Trollster behaved quite well, until the hard sand gave way to soft. Now Joe was struggling.
Shoulders stooped, rear end raised, he shoved Trollster forward.
Then something caught the front wheels. Joe was pushing so hard that he projected himself over the handlebar, head first into the groceries. Joe and Trollster fell sideways in a jumble of wheels, arms, legs and shopping.
"Oh, no!"
"Hey, I'll go and help him, silly old fool,"
said Colton, and bounded out of the room. Joe picked himself up, brushed himself down, and repacked Trollster before Colton reached him. Pushing Trollster through the soft sand was clearly impossible, so he tried pulling instead. I watched as Trollster balked and bounced, the wheels leaving tracks in the sand. Joe, pouring sweat, bald head, ruby red, fists clenched on the handle, was clearly struggling. "Where are the camels when you need one?" I thought. Colton, the knight in shining armour, arrived, and together they dragged Trollster home, up the lift and into our room.
"Trollster hates sand," Joe muttered.
"Sir Joe,"
asked the Filipino barmaid in Bennigan's later,
"why you look so red? What you been doing?"
"Oh, just a spot of shopping," sighed Joe, and took a deep draught of his cold beer.
Joe wasn't the only one with a red face that weekend. Joe was out visiting Colton in his apartment, and I was marking assignments at the dining room table. There was a knock on our door, which I opened, and found Darina holding a white plate, with a circle of plump, rosy strawberries carefully arranged. Perhaps I'm wrong, but I think school principals are rarely popular with their staff. Poor Darina was placed in a difficult situation. She was compelled to execute Mrs. Sherris's often eccentric edicts, but blamed for the peculiar rules she was expected to enforce. The coffee war was a good example, and she lost many friends over that. If people, instead of being poisoned by false accusations from the three fat ladies, had bothered to get to know her better, they'd have found a very sweet lady with the best of intentions. Yes, she made hasty decisions. No, she wasn't always a good judge of character,
but she was one of the most well-meaning and generous people I've ever had the good fortune to meet. And that day was a good example. Darina had bought strawberries and thought Joe and I might enjoy some. She spent time picking out the most perfect